This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are members of the Boston Globe's investigative team, which broke the story that Father John Gagan sexually abused boys and that Cardinal Bernard Law covered up the problem by moving Gagan to new parishes where he could still prey on boys. The Globe reporters went on to uncover the larger scandal within the Boston Archdiocese. Boston remains the epicenter of the pedophile scandal, but similar problems have been subsequently uncovered in many cities and in other countries. The Globe's investigative unit, known as the Spotlight Team, has written a new book called Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. My guests are Michael Resendiz, one of the reporters, and Walter Robinson, the team editor. Their investigation of the church began last summer, after Cardinal Bernard Law, the longtime Roman Catholic Archbishop of Boston, disclosed in a court document that 17 years earlier he had given Reverend John Gagan a plum job as a parochial vicar of an affluent suburban parish, despite having been told that Gagan was alleged to have molested 7 boys. The Globe reporters wanted to know whether the cardinal's action was an anomaly or part of a larger pattern.
The way it started in August, we had a new editor on board, Marty Baron, who came from the Miami Herald, published in a state where, as you know, virtually every document is public. Marty Baron arrived in Boston and began work the end of July, the day after one of our columnists wrote about the Gagan case. And she mentioned in passing, Terry, that all the documents in the lawsuit against the archdiocese involving all of these Gagan victims, all the documents were under a court seal. Marty Baron said, well, why is this the case? And he called the lawyers in. The lawyers quickly determined that it was in the Globe's interest to try to intervene in the case and ask that the documents be made public. At the same moment, we were asked, the investigative team, to take a look at the case to see whether it was worth investing the time of the investigative staff of the Globe, which normally focuses in on corrupt politicians and mobsters. We spent about 3 or 4 days in August looking at the issue, and instead of coming back with an answer saying there's a lot to be written about the Gagan case, we came back with preliminary indications that there had been a large number of priests involved in similar behavior, that the archdiocese had made secret settlements with the victims throughout the 1990s, and settlements that the lawyers involved called hush money to keep the extent of the problem quiet. So that's where we entered the case and decided it was worth our while because of what appeared to be an extensive problem that had been covered over.
Now, how did the Globe challenge the judicial secrecy, challenge the fact that the judges agreed to impound the sex abuse cases after they were settled?
Well, we consulted our attorneys and we filed a motion challenging the confidentiality order and saying that because of the public's interest in the issue, the confidentiality order ought to be lifted. And we also noted that in most cases, discovery materials are public. It's just part of the normal judicial process. And I think the argument that our attorneys made is that there shouldn't be any special consideration in this case. So it was a simple challenge on our part to the confidentiality order. And ultimately, Superior Court Judge Constance Sweeney ruled in our favor.
What was the church's reaction to the Globe's challenge of the confidentiality order?
Well, the church fought the order in court, and they argued that the constitutional guarantee of a separation of church and state meant that it wasn't responsible for revealing any of the discovery materials. They also wrote a letter to the Globe threatening legal action against the newspaper if we printed any information that was contained in the files, and also threatening legal action against the paper even if reporters interviewed priests. So they fought in just about every way they could. They also refused to answer any of our questions.
So you won the suit, and when the documents did become public, what were some of the greatest revelations in there?
The most remarkable thing about the documents, and this made it into the lead of our first story about them, is that they had virtually no mention of any of the victims or what had happened to the victims. And the correspondence involving the Cardinal and Father Gagan was extraordinarily friendly. Dear Jack, dear Cardinal Law, Jack the references are always euphemistically made. I hope you're having some success dealing with your problem. That sort of language is included in, and as we subsequently discovered in the cases of other priests, that coddling-type language is fairly common in the correspondence involving other priests who had the same problem.
Now, the documents that were released last January weren't just about the Gagin case. They were about other priests who had been accused of sexual abuse as well, yes?
I think primarily they were about the Gagin case specifically, and they were pretty wide-ranging. I think one of the other things we got from the document was medical records that led us to start questioning some of the evaluations that had been done of John Gagin and how the church handled that aspect of treating priests who had been accused of sexually abusing minors. For instance, the records contained a lot of correspondence between the Institute of Living, which had treated Gagin, and some church officials. And for instance, there was an evaluation that found that Gagin was a pedophile in remission, and it had a lot of language, a lot of cautionary language about Father Gagin. And then we found there was a letter from a bishop back to the Institute for Living saying, hey, wait a minute, this is not the sort of evaluation we agreed on over the telephone. I'm a little surprised. Can't we do something about this? And then sure enough, we found a subsequent letter from the Institute of Living saying it would be all right to return John Gagin to active ministry. But in that first data dump, if you will, those 10,000 pages were really primarily about John Gagin. It was after that, as the scandal mushroomed and all these cases evolved, that we began to get thousands of pages of additional documents about additional priests, in part through our own efforts and in part through the many other lawsuits that were filed after we started writing these stories.
When you were writing this story, were you worried about what it would mean for the Boston Globe to take on this really damning story about the Catholic Church in a city as Catholic as Boston?
Terry, I don't know that we were ever worried about it to the extent that it slowed us down. But I think all of us thought long and hard about what the reaction to the story would be in Boston, the most Catholic major city in America. It's also a city where the relationship between the Globe and Catholics has not always been as good as it might be. But I think we were all pleasantly surprised, I guess, after the story came out. And instead of being criticized by people who were loyal to the church and devout Catholics, we found that devout Catholics were grateful for the work that we'd done. And these were people who, I think, love the church and believe that it's a serious problem and it can only be taken care of if there's some light shed on it.
Were there any campaigns against the Globe during the early stages of your reporting?
No, there weren't, Terry. And I have to say, I half expected the day the first article was published on January 6th that there'd be protesters outside the Globe. What we did with this series, as we've done for a couple of years, is we published a contact box. If people wanted to talk about this series or give us information, we had confidential tip lines and email available. What became almost immediately apparent, we got two kinds of calls. First were calls from devout Catholics, and many, many of them from older women who had raised children in the church, who were outraged, not at the Globe, but at the cardinal and the bishops for letting this go on, for, in effect, putting their own children at risk. And the other calls we started to get, and we didn't anticipate this to the extent it happened, victims began to come forward to call us, many of them, most of them, men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, who had lived with the shame and the guilt of this abuse for years and years, who called us, in some cases, without ever having told anyone else in their life. Certainly never told their parents, hadn't told their siblings, and in a few memorable cases of people that we interviewed, hadn't even told their spouses. And because of what was published and the extent of the problem, as the extent of the problem became clear, more and more people felt emboldened or empowered to come forward and talk about it. And many of these cases were led to stories about other priests, one in particular, which personally was painful for me, about my alma mater, Boston College High School, which is a Jesuit high school, involving three priests there in the late 70s to early 80s who had taken sexual advantage of young teenage boys at the school.
Now, how did you check out these stories before publishing them? Because I'm sure that there was a certain amount of hysteria that was generated, too, where people had maybe, like, fake recovered memories about being abused, or that people were just trying to take advantage of the scandal. I'm sure most of the calls you got may have been true, but surely some of them were probably not.
There are a couple that stick out in our memory as being suspicious to us. But first of all, we had done a lot of research before we published anything and had built our own database of what we would call suspect priests, priests who had been removed from ministry and placed on a bureaucratic shelf, health leave, awaiting assignment, unassigned. This was a number of priests, over 100, who in the prime of their life had been taken out of parishes in an archdiocese, which, like many others, has a shortage of priests. And when we started to get records and the names of priests officially, they matched most often the names that we had in our database. And people would call and say, well, I'm calling, I read about Father Gagan or Father Shanley, and I want to know if you've ever had any information about Father so-and-so. And they'd give us a name, and more often than not, it would match somebody in our files, and we would get calls, often multiple calls, from people who didn't know each other, who were in different parishes, who described the same priest and the same modus operandi, the same way that priests used to lure the boy, or in some cases the girl, into sexual activity. And these people were very believable, and when we had multiple victims and other documentation, for instance, we had a list of names of priests against whom there had been settled cases. When we had all of those ingredients, we wrote articles about priests. We try and still try to stay away from the priest du jour model. There are literally dozens of priests who have not been written about and who are not in active ministry. And frankly, at this point, we see no reason to write about every single priest who allegedly abused children.
My guests are Walter Robinson and Michael Resendiz. They're members of the Boston Globe's investigative team that broke the church pedophilia scandal and has continued to cover the story. The team has a new book called Betrayal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Michael Resendiz and Walter Robinson. They're both on the Boston Globe's Spotlight team, and this is the team that investigated the church sexual abuse stories in Boston. And Boston, of course, has been like the epicenter of this story. They have a new book called Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. The book is by the investigative staff of the Globe. Michael Resendiz is a reporter for the Globe and a member of the Spotlight team. Walter Robinson is the editor of the team. Walter Robinson, you mentioned that I think a couple of the priests under suspicion were from your alma mater. Did it make it any more difficult being a Catholic to be on this story?
Well, in a sense, it did. I mean, it's painful. This is a story for which there have been no high fives in the Globe newsroom or in the Spotlight team about this story. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy if you're a Catholic. It's a tragedy if you're non-Catholic, given the extraordinary role the Church plays in secular life as a moral voice. It's in some ways, I think I try to think through the numbers. Almost all of the reporters, virtually all of the reporters who have worked on this, were brought up Catholic, have the benefit of Catholic education.
Was that intentional or coincidental?
It's coincidental. I think we were a month or two into reporting this before the four of us, the original four and the team, had a discussion one day in which we sort of compared personal notes and realized that all of us had been raised a Catholic and in some cases attended Catholic schools. I know I spent 12 years in Catholic schools, and in a way it helped us understand more readily the church, because we came from backgrounds where we grew up at the same time, I would have to say oblivious to what was going on, but at the same time that a lot of this illicit sexual activity was occurring. When I got a call from someone who said, I couldn't tell my parents, I understood, because I grew up in a family in which all of us were expected to attend church, to go to Catholic school, and priests were God's representatives on earth, and you never question priests. And if I can't imagine if this had ever happened to me, I can't imagine having told my parents. How would your parents believe that anything like this could happen? And so when victims came to us and told us how that they had kept this to themselves, I think we understood it almost immediately. We understood immediately the motivations.
How popular would you say cardinal law was in Boston before the story broke? What was his reputation in Boston?
Well, I think he's someone who was perhaps more popular when he arrived in Boston in 84 than he was, say, a couple of years ago. But I think there was still, before this story broke, extraordinary deference to the cardinal, extraordinary respect. He was one of the most influential cardinals in the country and the world. He was had access to President Bush. He was a leader of the conservative movement within the church. This is a very highly respected man inside and outside of the Boston Archdiocese.
And what about Reverend Gagin, Father Gagin? Did he have a high profile in the city before the sex abuse story broke?
No, he was a parish priest who had been in six parishes over 30 some years before he was finally removed in early 1993 from parish duty. He was well known he was well liked, as many of these child molesters are. They have a charismatic air about them. He was well liked and friendly and outgoing, as we've heard from many people in parishes where he served. All the better, or all the easier then for him perhaps, to lure children and leave parents in a trusting mood. He was not well known.
How did he lure children? How did he get these private moments with the kids where he was able to take advantage of them?
Well, I think one of the things that was most unsettling to discover was exactly how he operated. And typically we found that he would target boys from broken homes or homes where the father was not around or where there was no father, typically low-income families, typically where a mother had several children and was struggling to make ends meet, struggling to raise a lot of children on her own, and would be very grateful for the attention of anyone, any male father figure, and even more grateful when that attention was coming from a priest. So we found that there was actually something extraordinarily insidious about the way he operated and found his victims.
Now, you point out in your reporting that a lot of people are very angry with the church for seemingly having taken better care of the abusive priests than of the victims, for watching out for the priests more than watching out for the victims. And one of the examples that you offer is this letter from Bishop Law to Father Gagan, written in 1996. And it says, "Yours has been an effective life of ministry, sadly impaired by illness. On behalf of those who you have served well, and in my own name, I would like to thank you. I understand yours is a painful situation. The passion we share can indeed seem unbearable and unrelenting. We are our best selves when we respond in honesty and truth. God bless you, Jack." And again, that's from Cardinal Law to Father Gagan, written in 1996. The reference there to impaired by illness, is that a reference, do you think, to his sexual problem?
That is one of the euphemisms used. And yes, it is a direct reference, indirect reference to his molestations.
Michael Resendiz and Walter Robinson are members of the investigative team that broke the church sexual abuse scandal in Boston. The team has a new book called Betrayal. Resendiz and Robinson will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with reporter Michael Resendiz and editor Walter Robinson of the Boston Globe's investigative unit, the Spotlight Team. The team broke the story of sexual abuse and its cover-up in the Boston church and has continued to pursue the story. The team has written a new book called Betrayal. I want to quote something else, and this is a letter written from a Catholic psychiatric hospital in Maryland, the St. Luke Institute, after Father Gagan stayed there. And their diagnosis included this statement: "It is our clinical judgment that Father Gagan has a long-standing and continuing problem with sexual attraction to prepubescent males. His recognition of the problem and his insight into it is limited." What's the significance of that last part there, that his recognition of the problem and his insight into it is limited?
I think one of the things that some of the therapists we've talked to have said about these sexually abusive priests is that they don't appreciate their own guilt. We spoke with a therapist at the very beginning of our research who said that when he had a priest in treatment, it was always considered a big breakthrough when the priest was able to understand the effects his actions had on the victim.
These are, in many cases, emotionally and sexually immature men who, according to therapists, and this comes through in some of the documents about Gagan himself, where their development, both emotionally and sexually, was arrested when they were 11, 12, or 13 years old, when they found their vocations. They then went through this asexual seminary experience where the issue of sexual behavior was never discussed, celibacy was assumed, and then they were sent out to parishes where they immediately had contact with a lot of young boys, and some of them began to act out sexually, and with boys, they were attracted to boys their own emotional age, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old.
Let's talk a little bit about how this scandal is affecting the structure of the church. The church has, I think, already paid out a lot of money to victims who were willing to settle out of court. And the church, I think, still owes a lot of money to alleged victims. What kind of financial position is this putting the church in?
The Catholic Church has had a lot of trouble raising money just to fund its own operations. It runs a deficit here every year, and they're in the midst of a 40% cutback in their operating budget, much of this caused by people not giving now because they're so upset with the Cardinal and the Church for this sex abuse crisis. Here in Boston, where there are many more victims coming forward, there are several hundred people who have retained lawyers. Those lawyers are now in talks with the Archdiocese about reaching some sort of settlement, which we believe insurance would cover some of it, but the Archdiocese would probably be obligated somehow to come up with tens of millions of dollars. The early indications are that they will not be selling properties such as the one where the Cardinal's residence and headquarters is and St. John's Seminary, but that there are going to be cutbacks in programs that affect the poor, which the church has funded, inner city parochial grammar and high schools and other social service programs appear to be the most likely targets for cutbacks.
The Catholic Church has been very unbending on issues including birth control, abortion, divorce, celibacy for priests, homosexuality, women priests, and that has been very frustrating for a lot of Catholics who disagree with the official church stand. Now those Catholics have learned that the church has covered up the sexual abuse of children by priests. Do you think that that's going to increase the pressure on the church to change their point of view on things that they've been unbending on? Because a lot of people are questioning whether they are as morally correct and as they've always, as the church has claimed to be. I mean, when you have people in the hierarchy who are covering up pedophilia, it would be easy for some people to question whether these people have the authority to say, you can't use birth control.
Well, I think what's happened as a result of this story is that there are groups on the right and the left, and they both have agendas, and they're both using this crisis to further their agenda. There are Catholics on the left who would say that the scandal shows that celibacy ought to be reconsidered, that ordaining women ought to be reconsidered. There are those on the right who would say that the scandal shows that the church has been too tolerant of gay-oriented people coming into the seminaries and becoming priests. So I think there's an agenda on both the right and the left that's being promoted because of the scandal. At the same time, I think what people are seeing is that whether the questions are coming from the right or the left, the church has been pretty intolerant about debate. It's been pretty unforgiving of people who deviate. But when it came to priests who sexually abused minors, they were in fact very forgiving. And I think fundamentally that's what's bothering Catholics who are both conservative and liberal.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Walter Robinson and Michael Resendiz of the Boston Globe. They're part of the investigative staff that has written the new book, Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. This is Fresh Air.